Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gavaza, and for today, we are looking back at perhaps the biggest economics news of the week and probably the month as well, and that is the midterm budget speech that was delivered by Finance Minister Tito Mboweni on Wednesday, just outlining what the state of the economy is and what the plans are on the ground to actually get South Africa back on track. And to sort of help us to bring light and maybe unpack this a little bit, we are joined on the line by Nikki Weimer, who is the chief economist at Nedbank. So, Nikki, greetings to you. What do you make of the finance minister's speech this past Wednesday?
Yeah, I don't think it's a big surprise. I don't think there were any big surprises. In the market, certainly, and among all the analysts, we all knew that we're in an incredibly tight fiscal position. I think the bit that disappointed people really was that your debt trajectory is going to be a lot higher because, as has really custom over the last couple of years, they've again sort of scaled back the rate of fiscal consolidation and postponed it by a year or two. So now your debt sort of, your debt trajectory, this being your gross loan debt to GDP, it peaks at over 95 or almost 95% 2 years later than was suggested in the supplementary budget in June, where it would have been 87%. And then it remains high. So it is quite a substantial adjustment as far as that's concerned. But in terms of the, you know, this year's deficit and certainly next year, the plans of raising taxes, of cutting the public sector wage bill on the expenditure side, all of that is really pretty much in line with what they indicated they were planning to do back in June.
And then the other one that seems to have been quite a big theme on the day, and it seems to be a big theme of the big speeches, even the ones that are coming out from the president himself, is this issue of corruption. Is this just paying lip service to what has been a problem in the country for a long time, or does it seem as if there's actual plans on the ground to actually rein this in?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Corruption, I think South Africans, regardless of, you know, where they're coming from, educated or not educated, they all are fed up with corruption. And I think intuitively we all understand exactly how destructive it's been to the South African economy and to the quality of our lives over the last decade. So I think this is one key thing that people actually want to see action on, and they want some accountability. And, you know, I think I would like to believe that they are very serious and that President Ramaphosa and Finance Minister Mboweni are very serious about dealing with corruption. I think there are a couple of really positive steps. This open tender system that was announced during the a reconstruction and recovery plan, that is actually a very good move. It's a lot harder to cheat. And, you know, it's a lot harder to corrupt the system if everything is open and everything is transparent. And journalists like yourselves can go and trace exactly who gets awarded what contracts and where. And I think the decision finally to join the rest of the world, and especially countries with very low levels of corruptions, where, you know, government officials and office bearers are not allowed to do business with the state and nor are their relatives, that is also something that will have an effect. As for the progress being made in terms of actually bringing those responsible for past corruption and, you know, state capture to book, you know, I'm not sure what the progress on that front is. You know, the president says progress is being made. And I suppose only time will really tell us whether we will finally have some accountability for the damage done during that period.
And then, Nikki, the other one, which is, I guess, following on with this trend that a lot of the things, it's unsurprising, a lot of the things we've heard before, is that in South Africa, there are often, really nicely laid out plans for how to get the economy on the right path, how to create jobs, how to create growth, all of these things. So your takeaways from, the speech, how actionable is it? Simply because we are in a tough situation, as you pointed out earlier on, and not everything is going to be able to be addressed by the time that the minister actually gives the 2021 budget speech.
Yeah, no, listen, I think the estimates they put forward for this year to a large extent already reflects history. So they would have taken into account already what has transpired up to now. So they only have a few months left. So they wouldn't have, overloaded that period with too much actions. So what matters really is next year onwards. And their plans over the medium term, literally the name of the document, the medium term budget policy framework. And I think on that front, listen, it's going to be very, very tight. And I think National Treasury themselves admit it when they assess the risk to the debt trajectory. They made the point that implementation risk is exceptionally high. There is a huge amount of uncertainty around these estimates in any case, because nobody knows what the pandemic is going to do next, and National Treasury is no wiser than any of the world's greatest experts on this front, in terms of, whether the world will eventually bring this pandemic under control, and whether doing so will require further lockdowns. So this is an enormous uncertainty that still hangs over every economic growth forecast out there, and every debt projection that Treasury made. And then they admitted, listen, the implementation risk is very high. In order just to bring the deficit down, because remember, they're not returning it to sustainable levels at all. It stays highly unsustainable throughout the 3-year planning period. But just to bring it down to that 7.3% of GDP by 2023-24, they admitted that, listen, the only option really is to contain the growth in the public sector wage pool. There are few other options. They made the point that public sector wages have, to a large extent, crowded out all other forms of government spending, including service delivery. And I think that's true. Analysts and economists all over have been calling for action on the public sector wage pool. Given the tough circumstances, given that nobody wants to add to other people's financial misery, Treasury made the point that they're not going to tinker with employment levels in the public service. They're going to leave that unchanged. So no one's going to lose their job. But what they are aiming to suppress is the growth in the wage bill. So, and I think that is as responsible as you can be. So I give them credit for that. But they admit that it's going to be an uphill battle. As you know, they're breaking the 3-year wage agreement that was agreed on. This would have been the final year, and the unions have already challenged them on that. And they have their first court hearing, I think, in December. So the case will be heard then on the previous wage agreement, and then they have to negotiate a new wage agreement. And that will then apply for the next 3 years. So it really is going to be an uphill battle for them, and the chances that they might actually fail on the wage bill is quite high, I think. And so consequently, that will probably feed directly into an even higher deficit over the next couple of years. Although National Treasury have assured us that if that happens, if the court hearing goes against them and they cannot affect the wage cuts, that they will relook the budget altogether. So that's what they've said. They've said that one can't just assume that the higher wage bill will just be, lumped into this year's budget deficit. So we'll have to see. You're quite right. Implementation risk is the big challenge here. And there is unfortunately not much of a record in achieving fiscal consolidation over the last 10 years, just as there is not much of a record in actually implementing capital expenditure over the last 10 years.
Now, before we, you know, conclude the discussion, getting your thoughts on the outlook, there is one group of stakeholders, because there's a lot of different people that were probably listening to that speech and receiving different things from it. And one big group is funders, right? The people that are, you know, funding government, and one of the big sources of funds is the bond market for the government. How do you think they may have, what do you think they may have been, you know, looking out for, and do you think it was given to them?
All right, so I think that expectations were low in the bond market. That's the first thing. There was some concern about that higher debt trajectory. The moment it was announced, bond yields did rise. Since then, it came down a little bit, so things calmed down a bit. But to be honest with you, I think it's going to be very difficult for them to fund this particular deficit plan over the next 3 years. You're running really very big deficits. Your debt burden is climbing very rapidly. And with that, your interest service obligations also increase. The bulk of this deficit will have to be funded through local investors. At the moment, it's the banks taking up the bulk of the debt, so the banks are actually financing government debt. Hopefully, you know, the non-bank investors or funds will eventually join in and help facilitate the financing of this deficit. But honestly, what we've seen at the moment globally, and it's not just unique to South Africa, from the IIF that put together foreign capital flows into global bond markets and global equity markets, is that foreign investors have actually largely withdrawn from emerging market sovereign debts, and especially from local currency sovereign debt, which, as you know, is the bulk of our debt issuance, is in rand-denominated debt. And there's really been no return and very little interest, especially at the longer end. And that tells you that it's going to be very difficult for them to fund this particular deficit on South Africa's limited savings. And unfortunately, I don't really know the answer to this, and I don't know how it plays out. And I think a big reason for government's decision to actually go and speak to the IMF and get that particular funding is because they're well aware that the current global environment isn't actually conducive to raising funding. I think going forward, there is a hope that the economic recovery will, you know, restore some confidence and some certainly improved risk perceptions from investors, and that the high yields that we offer at the longer end of the curve will attract some investment. It might be speculative investment, but it will nonetheless help you finance your deficit. So I think that's the hope. And then obviously they're also planning to return to the global bond market from next year onwards and issue, you know, foreign currency denominated debt. But it's going to be difficult, because I'm not sure, with all of this uncertainty surrounding the pandemic and the fact that foreign investors have largely withdrawn from emerging market funding of local currency debt, how this is going to turn out, and at what point does risk appetite strengthen to such an extent that investors are willing to take the risk to come to countries like South Africa and perhaps benefit from the high yields offered at 10 years and over? I'm not sure. It's a very difficult one to answer.
And then finally, the outlook for the country, because that's one of those things that's been fluctuating over these lockdown periods over the last couple of months. We are all sort of mentally prepared for the fact that the economy is going to contract in 2020. But the estimate of just how much has been, you know, roughly going up and down. And even if it is by one percentage point, that translates into quite a lot in the real economy. So after this budget speech, where are you looking at things from that view?
Yeah, so we have a much more sort of conservative and possibly a more pessimistic view. The National Treasury, they see, as you know, the decline in GDP at 7.8% for this year, and we are closer to 9.2%. This is mainly based on the fact that we know Germany and France have now gone back into lockdown. And listen, you can print as many, you can print as many bonds as you want to. You can cut interest rates deep into negative territory. But if you put people under lockdown and you close industry, the impact of that is severe, as we saw in April. So now with Germany and France going that route, with infection rates climbing in the US, climbing in many other European countries, both northern and southern European countries, other countries might follow that route, and I think you're going to have another big knock in global growth in the final quarter of the year, and that will obviously affect us. And as a result of that, we've built that into the equation. And the other thing that we suspect might also happen and might also contain growth is that a lot of firms are only coming to grips really with what the future will look like around about now. They're adjusting their expectations on demand and turnover downwards for next year and the year thereafter. And they're starting to make plans to restructure, to change to a new form of working, to new ways of working, new ways of producing, operating, marketing, selling. And none of those are as labor intensive as things used to be before this pandemic struck. And so they're also restructuring, cutting costs, trying to restore their earnings, and the hit has been so big it will take a while. So I think job creation is not going to pick up quickly. The other reason we've got a weaker picture is that, unfortunately, with the pandemic still out there in the world, and if it's somewhere, it's pretty much everywhere, we don't think that international travel will be revived, not this year, probably not for most of next year, which means that our aviation, tourism, hospitality industries are in serious trouble, and they contain, and they, of course, are very labor intensive. They employ a lot of people, and we think that that drag will play out in GDP as well. So those are the key differences, I think, between our view and perhaps that of National Treasury.
So that's been it with Nikki Vimer, who is the chief economist at Nedbank, giving us her thoughts and impressions around the midterm budget speech from this past week, just highlighting the fact that they've taken a more pessimistic view driven by some of the developed markets and what they're doing in terms of going back into lockdown countries such as Germany, which affects the real economy. Also talking about the fact that at the same time, there might not be a recovery in travel and tourism, at least internationally, and not this year, and most likely not next year. And that is those are big labor-intensive industries, and that's going to likely have a drag on the economy. On the other side of this, we continue with the show. We are now joined on the line by Annabel Bishop, who is the chief economist at Investec. Annabel, greetings to you. Your thoughts just around the budget speech on the whole?
Yes, hi. Look, I think it was a fairly mixed budget. Why I say that is that the markets got some of what they wanted, but some of what they didn't want. And look, certainly that was the massive elevation in debt levels. South Africa saw its gross debt elevating as a percentage of GDP to close to 95% as its stabilization peak, also in a later period as well, 2025-26. And of course, you recall in the special supplementary budget review on the 24th of June, this peak was closer to 87%. And of course, around the 22-23 period. So that is very concerning for the financial markets and, of course, indicates an increased credit risk for South Africa, which is obviously an increased risk of default. And we have been seeing some, investor appetite impact as a consequence. But what the markets were hoping for was a cut in the government expenditure because, government is just exceeding its ability to finance itself. And, of course, we did see a very large expenditure cut and, of course, spread over 3 years. But I think the key point essentially here is that obviously looking at substantial wage freezes, and, of course, this has been one key area where we have obviously seen such an escalation in previous, well, basically over the whole decade in terms of expenditure.
And talking about the mixed, the mixed feeling that people had. Some things were quite emphasized, others were not as emphasized. And in previous conversations with you, one of the things that you seem to have been keeping an eye on a lot is state-owned enterprises, particularly around energy generation in the country. And that seemed to be quite lacking in the budget speech this Wednesday. What do you make of that, especially given the importance on the national economy?
Yes, so I suppose that's really a key point. When we look at our SOEs, which are the most important for our economy? And of course, the critical ones, of course, are electricity provision, water provision, sanitation provision, really services we can't do without. The point you're making here, I think, is that we were hoping to see a lot more discussed on them. And of course, with Eskom really at the top of its guarantees and get from government, I think government's really looking at different plans now in order to restructure Eskom's debt, to restructure the entity itself. But of course, we obviously would have liked more information on this, such a critical sector for us. And obviously what we did get was money being poured into SAA. And of course, that's really seen, as one of perhaps the non-critical SOEs, going back to, the start of our conversation here. So, certainly great concern there. Treasury was at pains to say that they're going to fund this over 10 billion allocation for business rescue. They're going to fund it through certainly reducing allocations to other departments. But again, the question arises, why do we keep hanging on to it? It's costing so much money. And of course, with tax increases coming through next year as well, there could have been a saving there, and that could have actually boosted the economy. So perhaps we'll wait till the February budget to hear a lot more on the SOEs. But in general, the medium-term budget policy statement doesn't give us as much colour as we would really like around this really critical issue.
And I guess maybe an extension to your thoughts, to that thought around SOEs, especially things like SAA, because the timing, you also then think about the timing of plowing money into an SAA, because arguments have been made about a country needs a national carrier and all of these things. But at a time where we don't expect tourism to rebound anytime soon, especially from international markets, you are at pains as well to also understand what the rationale is around SAA.
I don't think there really is any, valid rationale about a country needing a national carrier. Quite frankly, we have a lot of international airlines that operate here, and of course, we have some domestic ones as well. We don't need a government-owned airline, certainly SAA here we're talking about now, given the parlous state of its finances and mismanagement that's occurred over the last several years. And of course, you bring up an important point as well. Plowing money into it when the tourism is dead, and of course, you've seen recently this huge surge in COVID-19 cases globally as well. And that really talks to the fact that we're probably not going to be seeing much international tourism for quite a while. I think, what is quite key perhaps is that this money is needed for SAA. And bear in mind, it's probably only going to come through early next year. So the company, essentially, the airline being mothballed until then still, this money is essentially expected to be used to resolve the fact that this company is in business rescue. And of course, from that perspective, South Africa is obviously trying to show good governance and professionalism in that regard, repay the creditors, repay obviously the debt. But nevertheless, it's a hard pill to swallow in an environment where, firstly, it's the disaster at SAA has been very largely due to mismanagement, corruption, theft, and all sorts of other instances we know, which have, riddled many of the leeching of monies out of the system. But also, of course, as well, as it coming at such a crucial time when South Africa just has no money to spare.
I think the last point on this issue around SOEs, Annabelle, is maybe getting your thoughts around what is critical at the moment, because you've already mentioned electricity, and the case for a national carrier seems to be on the other side of the spectrum. But in terms of what's actually important at the moment in terms of SOEs and the type of color that you'd be expecting when we get that full budget in February or March next year, which ones are they?
Look, I think what's really critical with SOEs mostly is the fact that government guarantees a large portion of their debt. And what is critical here is that, we don't want government defaulting on its ability to, make these payments. Because, I mean, let's be honest here, it's government who's essentially making most of these payments now in terms of the debt. So from that perspective, that's probably the really the critical point, you know, that government's going to reveal in the budget next year in February how it's going to continue to assist these SOEs, but particularly, and I think the most important point is how it's actually going to wind down their debt. You know, we can't have these high debt levels and high borrowing costs running ad infinitum. We need to wind down the debt. And of course, that's where debt restructure for Eskom becomes so incredibly important. And after that, looking at debt restructure for these other SOEs. You know, you were perhaps asking me to weed out the ones which, you know, are the most critical for economic function. But I think, you know, all of them are critical from a debt perspective where government guarantees it. Government certainly doesn't want to be run any risk of the markets fearing there may be any type of default in any area that, you know, it covers. Obviously, you know, we talked about the ones critical to the economy, you know, from a electricity provision, that's obviously Eskom, the water, the sanitation, those are all key areas. But perhaps it's also quite interesting as well is that from the Economic Reconstruction Recovery Plan, we hear a lot about rebuilding or sort of improving the economies in the rural areas, rebuilding infrastructure in South Africa, you know, recovery and reconstruction. And of course, that a lot of that does include these services we're talking about. And that obviously is something which government is looking to do, private sector funding in combination with government partnerships themselves. So that's one area we could see an improvement in growth. But I think, you know, for our conversation we're having here, it just comes back to this debt and how's government going to manage it.
Outside of the state and the state of government finances, you know, just looking at it from that point of view, people would be receiving the budget or looking at the budget in different ways and looking for different things. So just from your vantage point, what maybe one or two key things do you think, firstly, consumers would have been concerned by or maybe impacted by, and businesses?
Look, I think certainly, I mean, this budget here doesn't give us anything really on the tax front. So, you know, from that perspective, we'll have to wait until next year. But it's been indicated to us we're looking at 5 to 10 billion increases in tax revenue raised from higher taxes over the next 3 years. So the medium-term expenditure framework, and of course, as you know, that, you know, really starts in the 2021-22 period. So, you know, running really the fiscal year next year, and then obviously the next two after that. And that's mainly be expected to be raised by not adjusting for fiscal drag, you know, not obviously adjusting for a situation where, you know, as your inflation rate rises, so the tax brackets are normally adjusted for. Otherwise, you know, obviously there's a real impact on your finances other than taxes. So that's expected to be the case. Government's not really expected to see very substantial tax increases, other than, of course, the normal increases we see for sin taxes, for petrol, fuel, you know, those types of increases. So really, from a tax perspective, it's actually expected to be quite muted. You know, we've seen the problem for the last decade has been a massive rise in expenditure, and we've obviously seen revenues not keeping up with that. And that's, you know, the reality of the situation. So the other leg of this is really improving efficiency at SARS, obviously getting the economy to grow faster. We talked about the economic reconstruction recovery plan, but that's not going to bear fruits immediately. But nevertheless, faster growth does raise revenue. But, you know, really improving the efficiency and collection at SARS. And that, of course, talks to hiring more people. There's about 600 to 700 vacancies there at the moment. And of course, as well, obviously improving skills and, you know, bringing in the big tax takes such as preventing base erosion, you know, profit shifting. And of course, as well, obviously looking at re-establishing the large business unit. And basically, these areas are really expected to start to provide substantial support going forwards.
And then on the workability, because this is something that is a common theme in South Africa, especially where the state's planning is concerned. There's usually great planning, but the execution tends to be a bit of a problem. Where do you see the risks on that front?
So I think, you know, what makes this economic reconstruction recovery plan different perhaps to other plans, that there's so much focus on this lack of capacity, skills deficit, lack of delivery in the past. And there's so much work being done on actually delivering. And, you know, you can certainly see that a lot of the plans, some of them are partially underway already. And if you look at the plans for electricity increased capacity generation, you know, that what we're seeing now is the legislation's been passed for independent power producers, obviously bringing independence into the private sector, into the rail system as well. All of these factors are very positive, and they start to show you that government's not trying to go it alone anymore. That was the mistake of the past decade, trying to pay for everything, trying to employ everyone themselves, and not instead allowing the private sector to, shoulder the burden and, do what it does best, and that is create, growth and jobs when it has got a very conducive environment to do so. Sadly, the environment's still not conducive. We've got huge logistical blockages, whether it's at harbours and ports, or obviously whether we've still got problems in terms of exploration, the mining minerals bill, obviously looking at, bringing that into fruition now from an exploration perspective into production. If you look at the big oil fields off the west coast, from the Cape, all of these areas are still big issues, big regulatory burdens. Of course, regulation itself is a very heavy drag on the economy. So I would say to you that the biggest problems really is still the regulatory environment we operate in. And, the fact that, yes, there are still massive skills deficits. And of course, that also isn't a problem when it's the regulators themselves and they are not able to issue the environmental certificates or, give the approvals that is needed. I mean, even now, construction activity can't take off in South Africa because most of the councils just are not back at work. I mean, these are highly, highly problematic factors from a productivity basis in the civil servants.
It actually does sound like there's a lot of things, a lot of pieces, like you're saying, that are missing. Some of the just a more practical thing, like a government office where you can just go apply for a permit to start doing, something. So going forward, your outlook for the economy, has it changed? Because I think in previous conversations with you, one of those things, and it's been happening throughout the fraternity in economics, is that there are all these upward and downward adjustments on the contraction that is likely to happen. So where do you sit after the budget speech on Wednesday?
We're probably around about 9% contraction this year. It's quite hard at the moment because remember we were expected to be in a good, strong global recovery now in the third and fourth quarter. And of course, there was one in the third quarter. In the fourth quarter, now we're seeing lockdown restrictions rise again around the world because COVID-19 cases are surging. And that's going to negatively impact global economic growth and, of course, impact, on South Africa as well. These are quite problematic factors because South Africa is a very small open economy. And of course, it depends on the global economic activity. Domestically, again, we were not expecting an enormous rebound in the fourth quarter like we had a big, GDP rebound in the third quarter, because obviously it's going to take quite a while for the economic reconstruction recovery plans mechanisms to really come into play to boost economic growth. In the meantime, we're still struck with all the structural problems that we had before. So, we're not seeing anything major as a consequence change of the budget. A lot of what is in this medium-term budget policy statement was actually announced in the supplementary budget.
So that's been it. We're with Annabel Bishop, who is the chief economist at Investec, giving us her insight into what happened this week with Finance Minister Tito Mboweni's budget speech, just highlighting the fact that much of what was in this speech came out in the supplementary budget that came out earlier in the year. Also just highlighting the fact that there were a couple of things that she would have liked to have gotten a little bit more color on, such as state-owned enterprises, but we're likely to see that detail coming in at the start of next year when we get the full budget. Also, just talking about the fact that their outlook is sitting at around negative 9%, just because of the risk of global economies and South Africa being susceptible as an open economy, and also just some of the domestic prospects not being where they should be.
This is Mudiwa's Tech.
Always good just exploring some of these economic topics with the minds like Nikki together with Annabel. And I want to just, zone in on one of the things that they both looked at as being risks for South Africa, and that's the increasing COVID-19 cases happening in other parts of the world and where lockdowns have been, reinstituted. And then there's the risk of the fact that South Africa is an open economy that's usually susceptible to global shocks. And one of the things that one has to wonder is, what does that then mean for countries that do go back into harder lockdowns, right? Because we've already seen how between the US and China, for example, there are a lot of economic dynamics that have changed because of COVID-19. The trade war continues, but China has become, for example, it's still a manufacturing hub, and they're still producing a lot of the PPE that's being used, you know, around the world, and they've been able to stave off or to at least control some of their infection rates. And then makes one think about the moment that we're in now, that if some of these countries are going back into harder lockdowns, yes, there is a susceptibility of a country like South Africa, but could we see other countries or other regions of the world that perhaps have been able to manage their rates of infection a bit better, the ones that are still able to perhaps continue with their economic activity, either switching, you know, to some of that production to fill in the gaps? Or is all of it just nullified by the fact that even though you can produce on the one side, the demand that would normally come from countries that are under renewed lockdowns means that that demand isn't there to meet the production? These are just, you know, questions to consider, because we are in a global economy, and globalization is one of those things that has been questioned throughout the lockdown. What is the purpose? What is the place of globalization during this time? And as different countries, you know, experience different waves, we've heard that the US, for example, is in its third wave of infections. We heard of second waves, that what everyone was afraid of when things first began at the start of the year. But now other countries are in a second, third wave, right? What does that mean for the global economy going forward? So that's been it. Thank you so much. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the Podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter, #BDSpotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your podcasted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller, together with Modiehi Mashemaete. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail, and this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning. We'll be right back.